Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Hey everyone, it's me, Reed Galen. As you may have noticed, I don't host the Lincoln Project podcast anymore, but I'm so excited to share with you my brand new show, The Homefront. On The Homefront, you'll get the same incisive discourse about the pro-democracy movement from the smartest, most driven people in the fight today. If you're listening to this episode on the Lincoln Project podcast channel, I invite you to subscribe to The Homefront on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. I want to say thank you to all of you in the pro-democracy movement, and I look forward to continuing our American journey together. And now, The Homefront. Welcome to The Homefront. I'm your host, Reed Galen. Today, I want to welcome back journalist and political reporter, Abigail Tracy. You know her from Inc. magazine, Forbes, and most recently, Vanity Fair. Last week, we learned she has an irrational fear of motionless escalators, which is going to be pretty tough to top, but keep listening, and who knows what other revelations might come to light. Abby, welcome back to the show. Are you still hanging out in D.C.?
Yep, still in D.C. right now. You know, I know you're on the road, so your stories will be far more interesting than me, you know, hanging out in my D.C. apartment.
Yes, I am currently sitting in my hotel room in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I was out in the Lehigh Valley yesterday, west of Pennsylvania by about an hour, hour and a half. It was the beginnings of what they'd call the T here in Pennsylvania, in Easton. And then I'm headed to Bucks County today, east of Philadelphia, you know, sort of the bellwether county in America, and then driving over to the great city of Pittsburgh this afternoon. But before we get to all that, Abby, let's talk dogs and cats living together and the idea that since the presidential debate this past week, which we previewed the last time we spoke, the thing that has dominated social media has been this idea, and I don't know what to call it, an idea, the lie that there are Haitian immigrants rampaging around a relatively small town in Ohio, eating pets and killing people. And I don't know, like, the truth is that even after all these years, 9 years in, right, we still seem to forget that there's no depth of crazy to a guy like Donald Trump and now his acolyte, J.D. Vance. But also that they never, once caught in a lie, they never recant, right? Like this. They always go further and deeper into the darkness. But from your perch, let me ask you this. When something is so blatantly not true and the mayor of the town is saying, please stop this, and the parents of the person who was indeed murdered are saying, please don't do this. This is giving us just enormous pain. And the schools have been closed for 2 days because of bomb threats. How do you cover that in any sort of rational way?
It's a great question. I do think, you know, looking back at the debate, David Muir did a good job kind of fact checking it in real time, you know, saying no. But it really, I think to your point, when you have a Donald Trump lie such as this, and then you have, you know, the enablers that surround him kind of continuing to parrot a narrative such as this one that's so ludicrous on its face, I think you kind of, it's very difficult to push back against that. Any amount of fact checking is really, really difficult in kind of these, because we've seen this, right? We've seen this for years now. Donald Trump has been doing this since his first presidential campaign, where he throws something out there, you know, many people are saying all of this. Right. And it's very, very hard to kind of unwind the tape a little bit, just because you have this environment that he has so effectively created, wherein there is right. this distrust of the media among his base and among his, you know, most ardent supporters and the ones that would most likely believe this crazy thing about eating cats and dogs in Ohio. So it's very difficult to kind of push back, because this is something in an environment that he's been sowing kind of this distrust and discord for so many years now.
Right. And, you know, looking at it from the political side, you know, I was born in the great state of Ohio in the little coal town of Marietta there in the southeastern corner, the first permanent settlement in the Northwest Territory for you history buffs. But, you know, this is the thing is J.D. Vance, Donald Trump's vice presidential nominee, is from Ohio. Right. I mean, right. he is supposed to be, you know, the born of Appalachia and, you know, the he's an Ohio State Buckeye. Right. He's supposed to be a proud Ohioan. And, you know, as I was understanding this from a friend who's, you know, very involved in Ohio politics yesterday, is that the migrants who have come to Springfield, first, are all legal. Second, the people who employ them are wealthy business owners who are big political supporters of Republican Governor Mike DeWine. And so these are folks that even the Republican governor's allies appreciate having come to Ohio and working in their plants and at their companies. And yet you see the vice presidential nominee and U.S. Senator from Ohio unwilling to defend his own state and residents of said state. And you have the governor, who's this wrinkled up old toad, Mike DeWine, who's been around. I mean, he's the perfect example of why maybe there should be, you know, there are term limits, but maybe there should be age limits. Like, you've just been around long enough, right? It's enough already. Go away. But that's the other part is, you know, we keep coming back to this, and I already know the answer, Abby, when I say it is like, have you no shame? At long last, sir, have you no shame? And the answer is no. Shame is gone. It's a burden for these people. They don't carry it. They don't even pretend to want to carry it. And, you know, I just maybe again, even after all these years, Abby, I just can't imagine a situation where I'd ever look in the mirror and go, you know what? These people have come from a pretty rough place. They have done what we've asked them. They've come. They've been good residents. They've been good neighbors. They've been good workers. They're working hard. They're paying their taxes. But no. For political benefit, we're going to put them and, frankly, all the kids, you know, and the people that work in the city at risk because of this one thing that started by a woman on Facebook who even now admits she made it up and right. I never knew it would happen. Right. I mean, it's unconscionable. But I feel like in this current moment, too, that my outrage and disdain has very little political purchase on the people that I need to convince that Donald Trump is wrong. And I don't even know sometimes how to decode that.
Again, you know, we talked a little bit last time about strategy and Donald Trump's strategy and sort of the approach to this campaign. And right. I think what we're seeing, particularly with this lie and like the continued push of this narrative, but also the reluctance by J.D. Vance, by others to call it out as what it is, which is false narrative. And what you're really seeing is back to this broader strategy. Obviously, the details around the narrative have changed slightly, but it's what we've seen from Donald Trump the entirety of his political career. And even prior to that, even prior to him running for president, he likes to stoke fears and prey on people's fears. And how he does that is often by, you know, quote unquote, othering individuals. And that's what he's doing. That's what he's doing with these hardworking immigrants in Ohio and, you know, pushing this narrative that really is intended to stoke fears and cause division. And that has always been his strategy and what he's run on.
And I mean, even I wrote on Substack all the way back in April, Abby, that I called it, you know, it's scare the white people time for the Trump campaign. Now it's always scare the white people time for the Trump campaign, because to your point, it's divide, it's, you know, distract everything else. And to your point, the Republican Party being, you know, its voters being 90% white, they know they're probably at risk in the suburbs if they're not already losing in the suburbs. And so they have to try and convince just enough of them. And I would say it's probably just enough white men, right, that there are indeed Haitians who are coming to kill your dog, right? Well, I can't have that, right? Or it's just one more thing, right, that convinces them that, Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, right, and Tim Walz are a bunch of Marxist leftist wackos who have allowed the border, to be porous and open, and the quote unquote caravans are coming back. So you're right. The truth is it's just the next flavor in the 31 flavors of insanity that is Donald Trump.
Right. And I think we also always see this from Donald Trump, particularly in instances and moments where he feels like he's backed into a corner. You know, he's like a feral animal in that regard. Like, if he feels like he is on the defense, if he feels like he's losing, if he feels like he's in this position, this is his strategy, is to kind of double down on conspiracy theories, double down on lies. And really, you know, he, to your point, has no shame, and he will say and do whatever is required in his mind to win and kind of win the argument. And in this instance, you know, we're coming off the debate where people widely believed Kamala Harris bested him,
right,
in that showing. And you're seeing that. You're seeing the polls coming out. Like, Donald Trump is scared. Yep. And, you know, this is what you're seeing. You're seeing him just grasping at any straw that he can. And again, recognizing that a strategy for him that did work back when he ran in 2016 is preying on people's fears and kind of stoking these fears. And again, this is a man who's shown us repeatedly over and over that he will do this. This is an individual who took out an entire page ad, you know, attacking the since exonerated Central Park Five. That was before he even entered politics. And then you have what we had, you know, in 2016 when he came down his golden escalator. Like, this is who this man is. And, you know, what they say is, when somebody shows you who they are, listen to them.
Believe them.
Believe
them.
Yes. you know the phrase, but this is just a different flavor of the same crap he's been trying to spin and sell his entire career.
Right. And I think for the folks listening, I think you've probably heard me say this over the years, but it bears repeating. And I hate to keep writing things, Abby, that, you know, keep being true even when I wrote them, but they're more true now, is if you go back to December of last year, and Nikki Haley was still in the Republican primary, she was asked a question about the causes of the Civil War, and she refused to answer, right? She refused to say slavery was the cause of the Civil War. And, you know, she spent the next 3 or 4 days cleaning it up. That's what a normal politician does. If Donald Trump had been asked that question and had given the same answer, he would have said, no, it was the War of Northern Aggression, right? It was the kind people of the South who were just trying to live their lives. And the slaves had great lives, right? He would have doubled and tripled and quadrupled down. They never come back to the light. They always go further into the darkness, because, again, any admission on your part that you've been wrong, right, threatens the Jenga game that you've built up over all these years. It threatens the house of cards that all of this stuff is built on. And I think that's the other point that's, you know, we forget, too, is that you're right. Like, Donald Trump is a rhinoceros, you know, sitting on top of a dreidel, right? Like, it's a very precarious situation for him. And at any moment, that balancing act, which it's hard to believe that he can pull off, but he has for a long time, anything that happens, and we saw it a little bit when he waffled on Amendment 4, you know, that would repeal the 6-week abortion ban in Florida, and when he went a little bit soft on IVF, right? It doesn't take much to push that. And I think the Harris campaign has done a very good job, and I think that the vice president did an excellent job of that in the debate. But again, once he gets a little off balance, that's the time when you have to keep pushing on him. And I think that, you know, as I said, I've been out here on the road, you know, in Pennsylvania. And as I went to the doors, you know, the people who were clearly, you know, maybe they were registered as independents, but they were clearly voting for Trump. Either they didn't want to, as soon as they saw us coming, they knew who we were. They didn't want to talk to us at all. Or they completely, you know, repeated whatever it is they'd heard. One guy that our colleague spoke to said the only person he gets his news from, Abby, and I know this guy personally, the only person this man got his news from was Dan Bongino. I mean, that's like, you're not, that guy's not coming out of the rabbit hole anytime soon, right? And so I think it's also important to understand that, like, from a strategic perspective, you have to say, what can we do here? Can we get more Democrats or Democratic leaning independents to roll out? Or can we get, you know, more Republicans to, you know, stand aside. And it's a hard sell, right? I think there are more Democrats available, right, to turn out or to register and turn out than there are any Republicans now. And it's not even because of Haitian cats and dogs. It's just because I think that, you know, I don't know really how many undecided voters there are, if right. that makes sense. I mean, there might be in a state like Pennsylvania, where I am, I think there's 23 electoral votes here, right? Maybe 10,000, maybe 15, 20,000 actual undecided voters out of the millions of people that live here. Maybe there's more. But the truth is that that's going to be the group that decides this. And it's an incredible thing that here we are 9 years later, after all of this insanity, after, as you said, Trump has told us who he was, and he's never lied about that, right? He's lied about everything yeah. else, but he's never lied about who he is. Here we are, though, you know, now 2024, 50 or so days to go, that we're still this close, that after all this, after all he said and done, that half the country's still locked in.
I guess, like, do you think that there really are any, like, true undecided voters at this point? Or do you think people just answer that way?
It's a great question. I mean, I would say this. We talked to one gentleman yesterday who said he was undecided, but you spent about 5 minutes, you know, with him. First of all, he gave us 10 minutes, right? So that's unusual anyway. But you spent a few minutes with him, and he got through sort of a list of broad concerns, which I think were legitimate. But then it was clear that, you know, he was an immigrant. He moved here 24 years ago. He's a U.S. citizen. You know, he's a teacher. And it was pretty clear that by the time we got done with him, that he was going to vote for Harris. Right. I don't think he's probably. And I think this is the other part. Is that, you know, there's this expression that I don't really care for called the double haters, you know, people who don't like either of them. And I think there are a lot of those people. They're just sort of fed up with the whole system. I don't really think I can blame them for that feeling. What I would say is, okay, I get it, right? It's imperfect. You may be unhappy with it, but, like, look what you're dealing with, right? Please just sort
right,
of
right.
be a grown-up. You know, American voters in the individual, right, are going to act however they're going to act. In the collective, I hope they do the right thing this fall, and we have to convince them of what that right thing is. And you have to have perspective. I think that's the other part, too, is to my Democratic friends, like, if you want to win, you have to say, like, we want to win. You should not vote for this person. You should vote for our person. Right? You should be very clear about that. I mean, you shouldn't be aggressive, you know, when you're talking to someone at their door. But it is something where I think once in a while you have to just remind people, like, this is not good for you. It's not good for me. It's not good for all of us. But to your point about the undecided voter, you're probably right. But I think maybe there's a psychological thing that says I'm displeased or uncomfortable with both of my choices. So I'm going to say I'm undecided, even if I know at some point I'm going to pull the right. lever for X or Y.
Right. No. And that makes sense. And then I guess, you know, we also have the group of, you know, first time voters, you know, the youth vote in this election. Obviously, both Trump and Harris are making quite the play to win over those individuals. So it'll be interesting. I guess, like, to your point around Democrats having to come out and say, hey, we want to win, this guy shouldn't win, I do think Harris did a good job of that
yep.
during the debate in a way that I don't know that we necessarily saw from Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton when they ran against Trump. I think, you know, one thing that really stood out was when she called out, she says, watch his rallies. Like, let him, you know, sort of this idea of let him bury himself with his own words and kind of encouraging people to tune into a Donald Trump rally, I thought was kind of an interesting moment and something that we haven't really seen.
Well, and I was texting with several of your colleagues, you know, during and after the debate, you know, and it's all goes back to the people we're talking about. Do the real folks on the ground here in Pennsylvania or Wisconsin or Michigan or Minnesota or Arizona, Nevada, wherever it is, do they really care? And I said, first of all, 67 million people tuned in. That's a lot of people for anything yeah. in this country now.
Listen.
But what I would also say is that, to your point, most people don't see Donald Trump in the wild. They might see if he comes to their town, right? They might see 30 seconds, a minute on the evening news, right? But they don't right. see an extended version of crazy, right, every day. Like, they're not tuned in like you and I are, right? Like, where we're, you know, we're scrolling all day saying, like, what's the next insane thing he said or did?
Mm-hmm. How fortunate for them.
Right. Yeah, right. They because not you know what? They live real fulfilling lives, Abby. Real fulfilling lives.
Yes.
And God bless them for that. And so, yeah, I think that's the other part is like, it's one thing to say, oh, yeah, you know, Trump's cuckoo and, you know, regular people don't really care. It's another thing for 67, almost 70 million Americans to sit there and watch him for 90 minutes. And I think that's why if you go back to even the debate with Joe Biden, that while the president had a disastrous evening, right, that Trump didn't seal the deal. Right. He wasn't so far up the next day or the next week that when Harris came in, that it was already too far gone. Right. I mean, I know some friends who work for, you know, a particular individual who had run a survey. I think I might have mentioned this to you in Michigan the week after the debate showed Trump up 6. OK, well, that's outside the margin of error. But if Trump was like 20% more normal, it would have been 20. Right. Like it would have been over. And
all
I think
relative.
That's
all relative.
All relative. Right. But I think that was why you saw that they went from that debate into their insane convention. Right. Where, you know, mass deportation. And that's the other part, too, is now, you know, he said he doesn't know about, you know, Project 2025. But, you know, he's doubling down because of the Haitian, you know, lie. He's doubling down on mass deportation. And he's even saying the Haitians, I'm going to send them to Guatemala or Venezuela. Like, I mean, this is also indicative of, like, to your point, like the things that he's saying. Oh, they're actually going to do like if they put, you know, 400 people on an airplane and ship them to Venezuela, like they don't care whether or not those people are Venezuelan. Right. They don't care.
Right.
They just want them. They want and I'm not even sure that they care about moving 11 million people out. I think some of them really do. I think they care about being seen to have done it.
Right.
So they can say, you know, we're quote unquote cleaning up the country. All right. So let's fast forward a little bit here. So we got 50 days to go. You know, some voters are voting as we speak. They're probably looking at their ballots. You know, when we were talking to a lot of people, you know, most of the people we spoke to, right, were registered voters. Most of them had a plan, right? About half of them said they were going to vote early or by mail. The others were very clear that they were election day voters. They wanted to go and cast their ballot. We talked to a few folks who were not registered and had no interest whatsoever in being registered, which, again, is every American's God-given right to not participate as well. So how do you see things here with a few weeks to go? And then I'll give you some anecdotes from the road.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of is wild where we're talking about it. We're talking about the, you know, the election being 50 or so. Is it 50 days away? 50 or so days until, you know, election day itself. But it is kind of crazy the fact that so many individuals are either already going to start voting by mail or early voting. And it's, even though we have, you know, a bit of runway left, I do think it's kind of crazy that coming off the debate, for a lot of people, the hay is already in the barn in terms of, you know, their judgment of these characters. Right. And I think it's going to be, I don't know what kind of data we're necessarily going to see, you know, coming out in terms of numbers of, you know, individuals voting ahead of the election or anything like that. But it's just so crazy to think that when did Joe Biden step aside? A month and a half ago,
ago
at this point?
Yeah.
8 weeks ago? It's just crazy to think about that Harris, you know, supplanted him at the top of the Democratic ticket, and that we're already at a point, you know, post-debate where people are voting. I think it's interesting. Obviously, the polls and, you know, how much we trust the polls is a debate for a different time, perhaps a different podcast. But when you're looking at them, it's close. It's very close. And in a number of these key states, such as Pennsylvania, where you are, where it's really going to come down to the margins and, you know, perhaps if they do exist, these undecided voters or first-time voters, it's hard to get my arms around it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, where I was, again, in the Lehigh Valley, which is, you know, is the beginning. So, guys, you know, there's, I think it was Carville or Trippy once said, you know, Pennsylvania is Pittsburgh in the west and Philadelphia in the east and Alabama in the middle, right? And they call that the T, right, of the state. And I was in the sort of the lower right quadrant of the T yesterday. And a lot of Trump signs, no Harris signs, a lot of Trump signs. You know, and it was interesting to see, Abby, you went from sort of exurban, right? Like, you know, lots of homes, you know, a lot of homes, but sort of spread out, right? There's sort of land around them, to working class row houses to sort of traditional suburban tract homes. And the dynamic of those neighborhoods, and I'll just utilize neighborhoods as sort of indicative of sort of where people were, could switch between the bottom of a street, you know, where you come to the rise in the middle and then you go down. I mean, that was the dividing line between two sort of demographic zones, for lack of a better way to put it. And it was interesting. I'm going to give a shout out to my guy, Jesse, who I was walking around with yesterday. I was like, okay, well, let's look at this house, right? So there's an RV out front, but there's a Mercedes in the garage, right? What does that tell you? Tells me it's probably a swing voter. Why? Because, you know, this guy probably owns his home, right? Like the rig out front is probably a 40-foot, right? RV, right? You have to have a fifth wheel. It's probably called a fifth wheel, right? It's probably a $100,000-$125,000 rig, right? This is a guy who's probably upper income. He's probably educated, right? Got a Mercedes in the garage. Again, there's money here. And so my guess is he's probably a soft Republican, right? He's probably not MAGA, might vote for Trump because of taxes, might vote for Harris because he just can't stand Trump. And then you go into, some multifamily, where it's multifamily housing, apartments, you know, those sorts of things. Again, you know, very, very densely compressed duplexes. And you see just a completely different demographic. And again, it's around the corner from one another. And so I think that's the other thing that we forget about Pennsylvania, a lot like Minnesota, right? Which is a lot of these states really are America in a, I don't want to call it a microcosm because they're big places in their own. But when you go out, you see everything, right? You see all parts of it. You see all parts of the United States. And there was one guy in particular that we went up to the door and we were about to ring the doorbell and he actually happened to pull up in his driveway. He had a smoker in the garage, which, you know, there's that thing on Instagram, Abby, that, you know, white guys in America over the age of 45 have to choose one of two hobbies, either World War II or smoked meats, right? I've been a World War II buff all my life, but this guy was
all right. So you went the World War II route.
Yeah, I went the World War II route. This guy was into smoked meats. All respect there. But he had a buzz cut tank top, big military tattoo on his arm. So I said, we're going to ask him, but I already know the answer, right? And we said, you know, we're here doing what we're doing, and he said, nope. And then he sort of gave us a snort at the end. All right. And so we walked on, and then we're in the car with our colleagues, and we're getting ready to drive back to the field office where we started in Easton. And the guy pulls up in his car, right? He'd actually been driving around looking.
Got
for
out,
us.
Got back in.
Yeah. So we're sitting at a stop sign, and he gets out of his car, and he starts yelling at us, and says, "You know, I'm a Marine. My son's a Marine." We said, "Okay," and he said, "You know, you people are responsible for the 13, talking about the 13 service members that died in Afghanistan when we pulled out. And, you know, the woman who's one of our state leads here for the union looked at him and said, thank you for your service, sir. It was the exact right answer. And then we drove on, but we called it a day in that neighborhood. But yeah. I mean, that's what you see too once in a while. I mean, he was out looking for us right now. Do I think he would have done anything? No. But he clearly was so agitated, right, by us even being around, right, that he felt compelled to get in his car and look around for us. And so I think that's the one thing you just remind you, you know, that when folks are pretty deep into it, and I have no doubt that his frustration and anger and fear is, you know, is in his head is real, right? You have to just remind yourself that, like, when you're out there, it's, you know, you are in the wild in some ways.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender, juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
But it also says that, like, Pennsylvania is going to be tough. Right. I mean, it's not going to be a cakewalk for the Harris campaign or I mean, I think Bob Casey, this guy, the U.S. senator here, is probably going to be fine. Very few Dave McCormick signs. Right. Way more Trump signs. One right. Dave McCormick sign, which I would also say to the average working class white voter in Pennsylvania. Do you think that Dave McCormick, billionaire extraordinaire, really worries about what you're dealing with on a daily basis? And I would say the answer is probably no. But again, you know, we're going to be in Bucks County after we're finished recording here again. you know, probably a very different idea. Suburban, truly suburban Philadelphia, upper income tends to be a swing county, right? How Bucks County goes tends to be how the state goes, how the country goes. So it'll be interesting to see. But, you know, in those redder areas, you know, the Trump stuff has seeped in. Near as I could tell, there weren't many Republican, white Republican men who appeared to be movable off of Trump or to Harris.
Mm-hmm. Out of curiosity, when you're knocking on doors and you're doing this, what is kind of, can you give me a taste of the pitch? Like what, you know, what you're saying, how you're leading into it, when, you know, when these folks come to the door?
It's interesting. So, you know, the guy I was walking around with, so he has like an app on his phone that has like whichever campaign has put all the voter data on, right? And it's got a little map and everything else. So it's, you know, it's fine. And it tells you their name, it tells you their age, it tells you, you know, how they're registered, and that's all public information off the voter file, right? And I assume that you know, whoever was putting these lists together was either going for, you know, Democratic households or independent households. And the reason why you do this, right, is not only so that you can convince those people that are able to be convinced that you should get out and vote for, say, Kamala Harris, but also because you want to know, like the guy we spoke to, like, don't go back to his house, right? Like his right. house, like you're not getting him.
He was certainly not an undecided voter.
He's a very like. Decided voter.
Yeah, he's
right.
not. He's not one of those. Yeah,
right. And but there were a lot of independents who were clearly going to vote for Trump. So like you take them off your list because it improves your ability to target. Like, okay, well, I know that Abby and Reed, like they're independents, but they're Trump voters. Like, there's no reason to go back to their houses. There's no reason to text them. There's no reason to phone them. There's no reason to send them a digital ad. All that other stuff. So there is a strategic impact of this. It also, you know, they collect data. I assume they're sorting through it to see what people's issues are, right? You know, not surprising, you know, economics, Social Security, the women, you know, it tend to be, you know, women's rights or abortion, whatever the case might be. But, you know, the pitch is, you know, we're here from blank. And they give you this script. But the funny thing about the script, and maybe I've been doing this too long, is like there's no possible way that anybody who was at the like had come to their door, right, was going to sit there and listen to 90 seconds of, and Kamala Harris is for blah, 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 blah. Like they're no one's going to do that. So you sort of look at it. Hi, I'm so-and-so. We're here representing X. You know, we're here to ask a few questions. Are you registered? Do you plan to vote? Do you have a plan to vote? What are your issues? You know, would you support Vice President Harris? Would you support Democrats in Pennsylvania? And then, you know, somebody has all that information and they click all the different boxes and they hit send and it updates that person's record. But I will just say this is like the technological revolution. A lot of people with Ring doorbells, right? If they have a Ring doorbell, pretty good chance they weren't coming to the door because they could see you.
Right.
Right. So they know exactly who you are. So like, I'm not dealing with that. Right. It's Penn State's going to kick at 3:30. Right. It's 3:15. I'm not getting off the couch for this jerk. Right. There's a stranger at my door. I'm not coming. So it's interesting, too. But again, most people, you know, if they do come to the door, for the most part, even if they disagreed with you, they were friendly. If they were willing to talk to you, I could say this is that if it was interesting that if they were Trump inclined, let me say that, like when they saw us, even though, look, I've got my Democracy Defender T-shirt on, it doesn't say Democrat. It doesn't say Kamala Harris. It doesn't say Tim Walz. It doesn't say anything like that. But like when they saw us, like they were like, no, no, no. So it's interesting for two reasons. One is if they see the word democracy, somehow they know we're not on their side, right? And two, my guess is there's so little Trump ground game, if at all, that if someone's coming to their door, they know that it's probably somebody supporting a Democrat for office. But let me just back up for a second, because I will say that, you know, in the Easton field office where we started yesterday, you know, there were probably 100, 150 people there getting ready to go. Either canvas or register voters at a farmer's market. And a lot of them had come from New York. A lot had come from Delaware. One woman had come from Virginia. So there was a lot of enthusiasm, you know, there at the beginning. And, you know, as you know, like there's that, you know, sort of rah, rah stuff. And then you get out on the road and it's like, okay, well, we started in Easton and now we're going to Allen Township, which is an hour and 15 minutes away. So like you have to sort of, that enthusiasm of the meeting sort of ebbs, and then you have to sort of get back up for it, if that makes sense, once you get out of the car. It might be like, okay, you're a runner, right? I think you ran in college, and it's like, okay, we're going to do a pep rally, and then we're going to get on the bus for an hour. So we were excited, and now we're staring out the window. And then we have to get off the bus to have a race, and now we got to get up again, right? It was a little bit of that. But that's, I think, human nature. So I think that the good news is that the Harris campaign and the Democrats don't seem to have a lack of bodies and people willing to do the work. But I would say that it is going to be tough right down to Election Day. And if you're listening to us and you live in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, North Carolina, and you are able to vote early, get that ballot, fill it out, put it in the envelope, send it back, or take it to a mail drop, or take it to your registrar, get it back in. Not only does it lock that vote in, guys, but it also makes the targeting for the campaigns that much more efficient because they can take you off your list. And also, it will stop people from coming to your door. If the campaign has already reported that you've cast your ballot, they're not going to come back, right? Maybe that's the best reason to vote early for Kamala Harris, is that you'll be out of the system, right? They're not going to call you. They're not going to text you. They're not going to knock on your door. But I'll tell you this, like, Abby, I would be lying. Like, I love this, right? Like, to me, this is democracy in action for all of it, right? This is, as we've talked about, like, democracy is messy, right? It's messy on purpose, because every individual has the opportunity to say, okay, I'm going to cast my ballot for them. I'm either going to tell you, or I don't have to tell you. Okay. But, you know, I love it. And I loved seeing the energy. And, you know, as I said, we're going to be heading out here in a little while to another canvas. And then we're driving across Pennsylvania. So my guy Luis and I, our deputy national organizing director for the union, will be recording a couple of videos as we're in the car driving across the Keystone State. But I would say that it is like I'm a nerd, Abby. Like, this is my favorite thing to do and my favorite time of year. And so it's, you know, here it is. We are into the campaign, right? We are into voting season, as you said. And I think that's right, is that I don't know how many people could actually be undecided. Now, that's the question I've asked myself. Like, after 9 years, there was a survey, I think, that Maggie Haberman from the New York Times referenced maybe last week, that 9% of some respondents in a survey hadn't made up their mind about Donald Trump. Like, how is that possible? Like, or they don't know what he stood for, or they didn't know who he was.
Right. That was the survey that kind of I read as well. And that's sort of why I asked that question to you, as like whether you do think undecided voters really exist. Like, I do much more understand, because I think in the same survey, I'm going to get the number wrong here, so don't, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But whatever number wanted to learn more about Kamala Harris was definitely in the double digits versus, you know, the 9% that wanted to learn more about Donald Trump. And that makes a little bit more sense to me. Like, I do understand that, like, the average American voter might not have, you know, quite the same grasp on Harris and sort of what she stands for, what her policy positions were, you know, what she voted on in the Senate and, you know, her time working in California. I do understand that. I guess the number that was surprising to me was, I don't know how 9% of people haven't figured out Trump. As you said earlier in the podcast, like, he's never lied about who he is. Like, we know it's baked in, I think, at this point. Whereas, like, I do get wanting to learn a little bit more about Harris and understand that, you know, her record and her policy positions might be a little less clear to the average voter who isn't like us, constantly consuming everything.
Yeah. And we've talked about this. I mean, being vice president is, I mean, if you've ever watched the show Veep that was on HBO for many years, and if you haven't watched it, there's no more realistic depiction of Washington, D.C. politics than Veep. There's 100%. Nothing else that's even close. It's not the West Wing. It's not House of Cards. It is Veep. That is it to a T. And let me just say that 90% of the people in Washington are Jonah. And if you get that joke, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I think Abby gets that joke.
Yes. I just did a rewatch recently, and it was
I know. And how scary is it that the writers, the Frank Riches of the world and people who wrote that, like, it's like The Simpsons, right? It's like they told us what was going to happen before it happened, and that the vice president doesn't really have a team, right? They have an office. They don't have any constitutional duties other than waiting for the president to die or casting tie-breaking votes in the Senate, right? And so, you know, they sit at the table and they learn. But as John, I think I've said this before, John Adams said it was the worst job humanity's ever created, right? And so that's not unusual that most people don't know Kamala Harris, right? That a lot of them don't recall that she's probably Attorney General of California. Maybe some remember that she was, you know, a U.S. Senator, right? But, you know, for Americans, right, out of sight, out of mind. Speaking of out of sight, out of mind, I'm going to take a total left turn. Abby.
Great.
I haven't asked anybody about this. The Taylor Swift endorsement. Does it matter?
I think it does. I think especially when we're looking at, you know, celebrity endorsements, questionable, right? Like, how much is Kid Rock really benefiting Donald Trump's campaign right now? But I think when we're looking at somebody like a Taylor Swift, who has this massive, massive audience, obviously, we've seen it, you know, this huge fan base, obviously, with her being on tour. And then I don't know if there's crossover with, like, her boyfriend playing football as well. But, like, I do think that she has a level of influence and reach that is incredibly unique and eclipses that of a typical celebrity. And right. I don't know. When we're looking at the Taylor Swift endorsement, I think it likely matters more in terms of turnout and encouraging young people to vote than really kind of changing hearts and minds, if that makes sense. Right. Like, again, kind of to what we've been discussing, like, I don't know that there's a voter who is like, I'm going to vote for Trump. I'm going to vote for Trump. And then Taylor comes out with her endorsement of Harris and is like, not anymore. Like, I just don't think, I don't know that that person exists. And they might. I mean, I'm sure they are humans. There are all types of people out there. And I'm sure there are some folks that, like, maybe would be swayed by that. But again, I think sort of it goes back to this idea around turnout. And, you know, this question about how many undecided voters are there really, or how many voters are really just considering whether or not they're going to vote at all. And I think that's where a Swift endorsement is going to matter on the margins in terms of turnout versus necessarily influencing hearts and minds. But, and I think you kind of saw that too, like the reaction from the Trump campaign and from, you know, kind of Trump allies to a Taylor Swift endorsement, like they got, you could tell they got ruffled, like they got a little salty about it. And I think that's indicative of, you know, the fact that it probably does matter a little bit.
Yeah. No. And I mean, as you know, I took my daughters to see her last summer in Los Angeles. And it was, you know, 4 hours and 70,000-80,000 people of it was unadulterated joy for 4 hours.
Right.
Everybody in that place, from the person in the rafters to the security guards, were happy, right? I'd never experienced anything like it, right? Just this, and as I wrote, like, they weren't singing along, they were singing with her. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, definitely.
It was truly impressive. And so I would say that to all the Swifty dads out there, like, listen to Taylor, right? Just do what Taylor asks you to, right? Because it's going to be better. Listen, if you took your daughters to the show like I did, right, you'd much rather live in Taylor's world than Donald's world. Let's just be clear about that.
You also just tapped into something, which is sort of like this idea of enthusiasm and joy. And, you know, you're talking about what that environment is like at a Taylor Swift concert. And I think we're kind of seeing that play out a little bit in the campaign itself, you know, back to this idea of, you know, pushing the narrative around eating cats and dogs in Ohio. That's fear mongering. You know, that's anger. That's, you know, trying to divide people. Whereas I do think, like, since Kamala, you know, replaced Biden on the ticket and, you know, she tapped Walz, who has very good, strong Minnesota dad vibes, I think you've seen kind of this split screen of, you know, one campaign kind of tapping into anger, which was an effective strategy, has been an effective strategy for a long time for Donald Trump, versus kind of enthusiasm, joy route, you know, singing along with Taylor Swift.
Right. No, I think that's right. And you know, that goes back to something that we talked about last week amongst, you know, your colleagues, which is this sort of ingrained cynicism, right? That joy doesn't matter. that, you know, the happiness around a campaign doesn't matter. And it absolutely does. And as I think if I haven't said it to you, I've said it before, is in my experience, nearly 5 years now fighting alongside Democrats, is that happy Democrats vote and unhappy Democrats don't. And I remember, you know, in 2021 and even 2022, people would ask us about Lincoln Project ads. Like, do you think they moved Republicans or do they just make Democrats happy? And I'm like, why couldn't they do both? Right. Like, if they reminded Republicans that, like, Donald Trump is not someone you should support and they made Democrats happy, like, that's what they need. Because down in the mouth, Democrats is what you saw with Joe Biden. Well, I'll vote, but it's not going to be about him. It's going to be about issues. And ironically enough, too, Abby, it's interesting that for a party that claims to be grounded in issues, their morale is distinctly and almost directly tied to the candidate at the top of the ticket. Right. which is, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I just think it's interesting. It's an interesting observation given that, oh, you know, we have to talk about issues. Voters care about issues. Like, yeah, but they really don't. Right. Like, they care about values and they care about it, you know, and they want to be part of a winning team. And I think that's the other part, too, is that if Harris voters think they're going to win because she and Waltz are at the top of the ticket, that's good for them. And if Trump's voters think that he's going to lose, then they don't necessarily want to be on the losing team. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think back to this idea of talking about issues, Donald Trump isn't going to be.
Right.
You know,
never.
So you got to kind of operate within, you know, within the system that you're in. And I think kind of
play the game you're in, not the game you know. Right.
Yeah, not the game you want to play, you know, and I actually think we have seen kind of an evolution of Harris and her approach to that since she replaced Joe Biden on the ticket. Like, I think she's kind of playing the game that she's in, yeah, in an effective way versus, you know, trying to make it a game with rules, a game talking about issues, and a game where, you know, the other candidate's not talking about people eating dogs in Ohio. Like, that's the state of play. And, you know, I think you have to operate within, you know, within the system that you're in.
Right. And listen, we've been at this game a long time. Someone asked me, was it, you know, did you feel good about the fact that the Harris campaign is now utilizing the tactics against Trump that you guys sort of pioneered in 2019, 2020? I'm like, yes, absolutely. There's only one way to beat this guy, and you got to stay in his face, right? You have to eclipse him. That's why he's gone so crazy, because the Harris-Waltz campaign, you know, is at parity with attention. I think that's one last thing on the dogs and cats thing, is Trump sees it's driving attention towards him, and he likes that. He needs that air, right? He needs that light, no matter what's causing it, whether or not it's the Klieg light of a television studio or the dumpster fire of his own campaign. He needs to feel that glow.
Yes, he doesn't discriminate when it comes to attention. So.
That's right. Exactly right. You nail on the head. All right, Abby, before we get out of here, anything else you think that that the home front listeners should take a listen to or take a look at?
It's interesting. I think just kind of continuing to watch the way in which, you know, the individual campaigns are going back and forth. I think what we saw, obviously, on the heels of the debate, Harris coming out to say, hey, I want to debate again, Trump saying not, and really kind of what we've seen from Donald Trump in the wake of it, in terms of him kind of spiraling out of control and not just pushing the cats and dogs conspiracy theory and, you know, false narrative, but also him talking about Harris having listening devices, like cheating during the debate. Like, we saw this in 2016, we saw it in 2020, but, like, really, I think continuing to pay attention, because I think some of these things are indicative of a different level of momentum across the country. But we still have a lot of runway left, but it's, you know, we're right in the thick of it. As you said, people are probably already casting their votes as we speak.
And if you have that ballot, as I said, I will make the case again. Get it voted and get it back. All right, Abby, before we let you go, where can our folks find you online?
So on Instagram, I'm at Abby Tracy, ABBYTRACY. And on Twitter, or X rather, I'm at Abigail Tracy, ABIGAILTRACY.
All right. As always, gang, you can find me over at Substack, also the home front. I hope you will sign up. And on Twitter and TikTok, at Reed Galen. On Threads and Instagram, at Reed_Galen. USA. Everybody, if you are listening to my voice, I need you to go to your podcast app. I need you to follow this show. I need you to rate this show 5 stars. Guys, we are on the charts, but we need to stay on the charts, and you all will help us make that happen. All right, Abby, we will be back in a week to discuss what insanity has transpired in the next 7 days. Until then, thanks for joining me, and everybody else, we'll see you next time.